Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. excuse me. Welcome to the Parliamentary Library and to the 2016 Budget Seminar. My name is Jonathan Curtis. I'm the Assistant Secretary, Research Branch. And this year's seminar will follow the usual format that we have done in previous years. Two senior researchers from the economics section will be giving a briefing on the forthcoming budget. Robert Dollimore will offer some thoughts on the context of the 2016-17 budget, and Daniel Waite will give an overview of the budget papers, including how to read them and how to understand them, which is, as always, no easy task given their large dimensions. Daniel's presentation will go for about 25 minutes. Robert's will go for about 15. I'd ask you to hold all your questions until the end of that time, and then we'll use the remaining time for question and answer discussion, and we'll finish up within the hour. So without any further ado, I'll invite our first speaker. Please welcome Robert.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for coming along today. The main part of today's discussion is going to be Daniel's talk about the budget process and papers. I'm really just his support act, and I'm here to get you warmed up with a few comments about the context of this year's budget. It's not going to be a comprehensive assessment of the global and domestic outlook. If you need more information, please feel free to contact us here in the library, and we'll be happy to put some material together for you. I do just want to briefly touch on global growth and risks, domestic growth and risks, the other economic policy levers, and finally I'll be leaving you with some high-level questions which are really just intended to help you think broadly about the budget. Some 8 years after the GFC struck, it's fair to say the global economy really remains stuck in low gear, and the recovery is fragile. Over the last year, there have been bouts of heightened market volatility, global growth remains relatively soft, and significant downside risks remain. Globally, policymakers continue to have to confront some difficult questions. In this environment, what policies are needed to achieve a sustained lift in economic growth? How do we normalise monetary and financial conditions? How do we make sure we are well prepared in case the downside risks materialise? Casting our minds back to January, the year got off to a particularly bumpy start. There was heightened volatility in global financial, equity and commodity markets. Markets seemed to be focusing more strongly on some of the downside risks facing the global economy, including concerns about China, its growth prospects and financial market risks, falling commodity prices, particularly the price of oil, and US monetary policy beginning to diverge from that of other major central banks, and the flow-on effects of all these developments for the growth prospects and financial stability of emerging market and developing economies. Since then, markets have calmed, but there remain concerns about the extent to which market sentiment in this environment remains relatively unanchored, lacking that clear sense of what the new long-term sustainable growth path is. In this environment, further bouts of market volatility cannot be ruled out. So just looking at some numbers, as you know, the International Monetary Fund regularly updates its global forecasts. Post-GFC, it's fair to say that forecasters have faced a particularly difficult time, and the IMF is no exception. Downward revisions to the IMF forecasts have not been uncommon. Nevertheless, they remain for us a useful international benchmark. If we look at how the IMF's growth forecasts have tracked over the past year, we see it has revised down the near-term outlook for the global economy, Back in April last year, it was forecasting the global economy would grow by around 3.8% this year. It's now forecasting growth of 3.2%. On the positive side, the IMF is expecting growth to pick up a notch next year and to be around that 3.9% mark going forward. 3.8% mark going forward. So, how does this outlook compare with past periods? If we turn back the clock to the period immediately before the GFC, say between 2000 and 2007, there was a reasonable chance global growth would have had a 4 or perhaps even a 5 in front of it. Over that period, taking a simple average, global growth averaged around 4.5%. If we look back a bit further, say between 1990 and 2007, global growth averaged around 3.7% a year, still a good bit higher than where we are today. Importantly, since the GFC, between 2008 and 2015, global growth has averaged just 3.2% a year. So in that context, the IMF's latest growth forecast for 2016, it looks like we're growth's holding steady, but we haven't really seen that sustained improvement we've been hoping for. It's always good to have a point of comparison. This chart simply compares the latest IMF growth forecast with those of Oxford Economics. The outlook is broadly consistent, and like the IMF, Oxford Economics is forecasting global growth will pick up a notch next year and be somewhere around that 3.7% mark going out to 2019. The global economy continues to face some significant downside risks. There is a risk that further sustained financial market volatility could result in rising risk premiums and tightening financial conditions. As well as investment taking a hit, it would also likely to dampen global demand through confidence and wealth channels. As we saw earlier this year, markets are particularly sensitive to any sign growth is slowing in China by more than currently forecast. If China's growth was to slow suddenly by more than currently forecast, there's a risk this could trigger further market volatility. Sudden reversals of capital flows to emerging market economies for whatever reason would likely see financial conditions in those economies tightening, and the currencies and balance sheets of those economies put under considerable pressure. There's a risk of persistently slow growth. And more than that, the growth is not only slow, but economies struggle to really use fully their productive potential. There are various versions of this story. One is simply a sustained weakening of demand relative to supply, flowing through to weaker investment and employment growth and declining potential growth rates. If Britain votes to exit the EU, it is likely there would be considerable uncertainty both for Britain and Europe going forward. There is a risk in the short term this could trigger further financial market volatility with negative flow-on effects for the rest of the world. Geopolitical tensions have the potential to disrupt global financial investment and trade flows and dampen confidence. So in this uncertain environment, what's the IMF's latest advice to the global community? Do more to support growth. Make the best use of all available policy instruments. And when you're putting together policy packages, have regard for the distributional issues the social impact of economic policies. Be prepared in case the downside risks materialise, with the IMF particularly drawing attention to the potential for international cooperation. For policymakers globally to cooperate in developing contingency plans and the potential to strengthen the global financial safety net and regulatory system. Of course, what this means for individual countries will vary depending on their circumstances. There is no one-size-fits-all solution. Turning to the Australian economy, Australia continues to enjoy a long period of unbroken economic growth, which is a significant achievement, particularly in view of some of the challenges the economy has faced in recent years. The shock of the global financial crisis, and more recently, falling terms of trade, the unwinding of mining investment, an uncertain global outlook triggering market volatility. Over the past year, there have been encouraging signs that the transition to broader-based growth has gained some traction. Employment growth in the non-mining sector has been strong, and readings of business conditions and confidence have been solid. The impetus for rebalancing towards non-mining sector activity has come primarily from dwelling investment and consumption, supported by accommodative monetary policy. And there have also been some recent gains in some of Australia's non-mining export-oriented industries such as tourism and higher education. A sustained lift in non-mining business investment remains the next important piece of the puzzle in terms of Australia's transition to more balanced growth. Growth is expected to firm gradually over the next few years. Nevertheless, significant downside risks remain. And if we look further out, there are both long-term opportunities and challenges which are an important backdrop to the budget. Looking at the IMF's latest set of numbers for Australia, the IMF has also revised down its near-term outlook for the Australian economy. In April last year, it was forecasting growth of 2.8% in 2015, increasing to 3.2% this year. The IMF revised the 2016 forecast down to 2.5%. But on the positive side, we see this large forecast pickup in growth next year and the IMF's expectation that growth will be somewhere around the 3% mark in 2018 and 19. So just looking again at those longer term averages, if we look both for the period 2000 to 2007 and 1990 to 2007, we see Australia's growth averaged a bit over 3% a year. Since the GFC, we've had growth on average around 2.5% a year. So again, this year's growth forecast looks about is holding steady, but again, we haven't seen that lift yet in growth. So this chart just compares the IMF and Oxford Economics' latest forecasts. Oxford Economics is a bit more optimistic about the growth of this year, forecasting 2.8%. But like the IMF, the outlook is pretty much growth around the 3% mark going out to 2019. Australia also faces some significant downside risks. If the Chinese economy slows more sharply than currently forecast, it's reasonable to expect that there'd be weaker demand for our commodity exports and other exports, weaker Chinese investment, and the negative confidence and wealth effects these developments would likely have. There's a risk that sustained global financial market volatility would see Australia adversely affected by tightening global financial conditions, weaker investment and trade flows, and again, the negative confidence and wealth effects these developments would have. Domestically, there's a risk that the pickup in non-resource demand is slower or not sustained, feeding through into weaker investment and employment outcomes. And of course, the level of the Australian dollar remains central to this story. A sharp downturn in the housing market would expose households and the banking sector to increased stress, which would likely see weaker domestic demand, accentuated by tightening credit conditions and negative confidence and wealth effects. Taking a somewhat longer-term perspective, the budget is also framed against a backdrop of longer-term challenges and opportunities, such as an ageing population, climate change, natural resource depletion, the economic rise of Asia, changing patterns of global demand, and new knowledge and technologies. This chart really is just a reminder on Budget Day that there are other arms of economic policy, and it's useful to think about what's happening in those other areas. What can reasonably be expected from each of these arms of policy in terms of fostering stronger, sustainable economic growth? And if we were taking up the IMF's advice, asking whether we are making the best use of all available policy instruments. Finally, I just want to leave you with some high-level questions which my colleagues and I have sort of developed over time. They're just intended to encourage a broad perspective of the budget. There's always a lot of focus on the numbers, but it's also to ask some questions around the overall package. What's the government trying to do? How ambitious is it? The narrative. What's the overarching narrative? How well does it align with Australia's current circumstances? The actual budget measures, trying to determine what's actually a new measure and what's not, and are the budget measures consistent with the narrative? The risks confronting the budget outlook, what's the narrative around those risks? And how does that compare to what other commentators are saying? And finally, to the extent there's any unfinished business, what adjustment is still needed? And given the challenges Australia faces, what are the likely future pressure points? That's all I really wanted to say today. Thank you for listening. And Dan will continue on.
Well, thank you. Now, I'm going to look a little bit more directly at the budget proper, what we imagine as the budget on Budget Day. And firstly, I'm going to talk a little bit about the context for this year's budget. Now, in prior years, we've tended to talk about deficits and surplus and debt as they have been the issues that have occupied people's minds prior to the budget. This year's a little bit different. The actual delivery of the budget and the timing of the budget is a particularly interesting issue this year. And also, one issue did appear to arise recently in relation to the budget, and it dealt with the structure of the Commonwealth budget in relation to the state and territories as well. And I'll have a quick look at that. Okay. Now, this year, the budget is an earlier budget. Now, why I say an earlier budget is that up until 1993, the Commonwealth actually delivered its budget partway through the financial year. So each year they would introduce a supply bill at the start of the year, and that would provide sufficient funding to get them to the point at which they delivered the full budget. In 1994, they decided that was somewhat inconvenient, and they started doing what they called an early budget. Now, the early budget has generally been delivered on the second Tuesday of May. It removes supply as an issue, and it makes those supply bills unnecessary. Now, as you're probably aware, this year is is just different. There is the speculation that the Prime Minister will seek to go to a double dissolution, and that changes significantly the budget timeframe. So we saw yesterday supply bills introduced into the chambers, and they're being debated, as I understand, in the Senate today. So it's an unusual budget, and it's really brought the focus maybe away from those bigger economic issues down to really the procedural and the technical way in which this budget will pass through the chambers, which I think is somewhat uncertain at this stage. I also want to talk about the topic of vertical fiscal imbalance. Now, that's not a particularly nice term, but it's an important term. This concept arises in most federal systems where the tendency is for national governments to have greater revenue raising capacity than the lower level governments. In Australia, we have vertical fiscal imbalance, and it's a particularly pronounced level of vertical fiscal imbalance relative to other federal systems. This chart here, just to illustrate this issue is important, I think, this year, because at the 1 April COAG meeting, the Prime Minister obviously floated the idea that he would transfer some taxing powers back to the states to allow them to fund their own activities rather than relying so much on the Commonwealth. I think if anything particularly significant happens in this budget, it's likely to be in this area of Commonwealth-state relations, where maybe they change the way in which they provide money to the states. Now, just to illustrate the level of vertical fiscal imbalance, I've got this chart here. This shows that in, say, 15-16, the Commonwealth raises around $400 billion a year in revenue, but in terms of direct expenditure related to the Commonwealth itself, it only spends about $300 billion. So there's a gap there of about $100 billion. And if we have a look at the states, you'll see that the states collectively raise maybe $140 billion a year, except their expenditure is well over $200 billion a year. So there's obviously a mismatch here. And this is where the role of Commonwealth financial grants from the Commonwealth to the states comes in. And if I just show those, you can see that the Commonwealth's making about $100 billion a year in grants to the states, and that's basically topping up or providing for that additional expenditure or revenue required by the states. So this is essentially, when you hear about funding for healthcare and funding for education, this is really the central issue that's going on here. Okay, now I'd just like to talk about some of the key concepts that are used in the budget. Okay, now formally the budget, or what transpires in the Houses of Parliament during budget week or following budget week, is the Parliament votes to release money from this consolidated revenue fund, which is established in the Constitution. All government expenditure needs to be authorised in one way or another by an appropriation by the Parliament. So it's critically important, whether you're working for the government or you're working in an opposition member's office, fundamentally the budget is about Parliament's authorisation of expenditure by the executive government. Now, there are various ways in which money can be released from that consolidated revenue fund. At 7:30 this evening, the Treasurer will table what are called annual appropriation bills. These provide for money for roughly 1 year, and each year they have to be reintroduced. There are three main annual appropriation bills tabled on budget evening. Appropriation Bill number one, number two, and a bill for the parliamentary departments. I've also put supply bills in there because they are also annual appropriation bills, but they were tabled yesterday, so they won't form part of this budget package. Now, despite the focus very much being in parliamentary terms on these annual appropriation bills, only about 20% of the Commonwealth's expenditure each year is provided by these annual appropriation bills. The vast majority of the Commonwealth's expenditure on large programs such as healthcare, social security, are provided by things called special appropriations. Now, these are in, for example, the Social Security Act. It establishes all the types of payments that are available, all the criteria that have to be met in order to receive a payment, but it also provides a special appropriation which once an applicant has met all those criteria, automatically appropriates the money. Now, this is particularly significant, I think, because if the government wants to change the amount of money that's being spent under these sort of special appropriations, it often has to actually go and change the terms and or the criteria in the legislation itself. It can't do what it can maybe do in an appropriation, in an annual appropriation bill, and simply reduce the amount of money that it's spending in a given year. In order to change expenditure on unemployment benefits, you need to go and change the criteria or the conditions that are attached to receiving those benefits. Now, there are some legislative devices, really, that provide for an appropriation, but they provide for it in a slightly different way. There are things called special accounts. Now, special accounts are basically buckets of money which remain in the Consolidated Revenue Fund, but they are able to be drawn on when certain criteria are met. Now, governments typically use these in order to specifically allocate certain amounts of money for certain areas or activities. An example, and I think there is a special account for water reform, for example. So the Commonwealth has basically said, we're prepared to commit, say, $2 billion to water reform. When the conditions for accessing the money, so it might be that the Commonwealth has concluded the purchase of someone's water entitlement, that activates the criteria that attach to the special account, and that money is then released. Now, you might fund some programs which are actually quite difficult to understand how they might be funded. Sometimes they're funded by a special account, so there's both there's a criteria attaching to the amount of money that can be when the money can be released, and there's also a maximum limit on the amount of money that can be released. Another way in which agencies tend to fund themselves, and it still formally does involve an appropriation, but it's the retaining of what's called own source revenue, or sometimes called Section 74 receipts under the PGPA Act. The terminology varies a little bit. This can be a particularly important source of revenue or resources for some agencies where they are partly self-funded. So regulatory agencies, say ASIC or something like that, they are often able to, when they receive money in the nature of application fees or payments for authorising things, they're often able to retain those monies and use them to fund their ongoing operations. So it's not, and these will appear separately in the financial statements of those entities. So if you have a question along the lines of how much does an entity cost, or what resources are available to the entity, it's the appropriations that they receive, but sometimes it's also this own source revenue, the money which they're able to retain. Now, the government uses two different types of accounting in its budget papers, and it does lead to some confusion at times. There's a measure called the fiscal balance, which is used commonly through state governments, and it's used in the Commonwealth's budget papers in places. Now, this is an accrual measure of the government's fiscal position. Now, what accrual means is that it disregards when cash is actually received or paid, and it looks at when expenses are incurred and revenues are earned. Now, this has the implication that if the Commonwealth signs a contract today for $5 billion, but it doesn't have to pay the money for 6 months, in accrual terms, it's incurred the expense. In cash terms, it hasn't yet had to pay it. Now, that's not the Commonwealth's preferred measure. The Commonwealth actually prefers to use a measure called the underlying cash balance when it's talking about its deficit or surplus. This is a measure which uses that of cash accounting. So in that example of when you sign a contract under the, but you don't have to pay the money for a period of time, under the underlying cash balance measure, you wouldn't look at that, that you wouldn't incur an expense when you signed the contract, but rather when you had to make the cash payments. It does lead to a little bit of confusion, and sometimes you can see quite different outcomes depending on which measure is being used. But generally, if the government, when the government says this evening that the surplus or the deficit is a particular number, they are talking about the underlying cash balance. Now, the majority of the focus, I think, in each year is basically on the when people look at the budget, is on the policy decisions that the government makes. So, some examples of policy decisions the government might make: new expenditure, new programs, changing eligibility for certain programs, or changing the tax laws. They are all generally in places in the budget grouped together as policy decisions. These are things which the government has direct control over, or reasonably direct control over, and all the financial consequences that flow are basically to flow from the decisions of the government. At the same time, there is a competing force in the budget each year, which is what are generally referred to as sort of parameter variations. This is the types of variables which the Commonwealth doesn't have any direct control over. This can hit all parts of the government's finances and reflect things like changes to corporate profits, unemployment, employment. An example would be companies pay tax on their profits, so company tax profits are lower, company tax is also likely to be lower. Likewise, employees pay income tax. If employment's lower, income tax receipts are lower. They can also affect expenditure items, so if there are more people who are unemployed and in receipt of unemployment benefits, that can also drive a greater expenditure for unemployment benefits, which the government essentially has to incur. There's no way in which they can directly control that. I've also put Medicare claims there as an example. There are other parameter variations which have a very long-term effect, so an ageing population, advances in medical science, which maybe makes the cost of delivering, you know, world-class healthcare twice as expensive as it was a decade ago. There can also be long-term effects that drive expenditures of the Commonwealth. Now, a concept used in the financial statements of the agencies and throughout the agency, the details of what the agencies do, is this concept of administered and departmental. Now, it's easy, I think, to start with administered expenses and explain what they are, and then we can work out what departmental expenses are. Administered items are things which the agency does on behalf of the Commonwealth. So the Department of Social Security pays Social Security payments on behalf of the Commonwealth. It doesn't have direct access to or control over that money. The vast majority of programs and activities that are undertaken by the Commonwealth are administered programs. So if you're looking for a particular activity in the education department, you'll often find that it's an administered program, it's a specific amount of money. Departmental expenses are basically the cost of running the bureaucracy of the Commonwealth. So it's salaries and wages of staff, it's office supplies, it's buying new computers. There are some programs which are in the nature of this departmental, which are departmental in nature. These are things like grant programs where an agency's been given a specific amount of money and they have some discretion about what the criteria for awarding those grants are. I'll give you an example of an administered item which might seem a little bit counterintuitive. The building we're in right now, Parliament House, is it's within the Department of Parliamentary Services activities, but it's an administered asset because the Department of Parliamentary Services administers this building on behalf of the Commonwealth. It doesn't have direct control over the way in which, over the custody of the building. All right, now we'll go to the budget papers proper. Okay, now, in each year, this is basically the types of budget papers that there are. When the Treasurer starts his speech, he will table an appropriation bill like this. They look remarkably like most other bills. You'll notice that they basically have lots and lots of financial tables at the back. They are very important. They're critical to the budget process. I must admit, though, that delving into the appropriation bills is often a bit of a fraud exercise, and they often don't include a great deal of additional information. They will have, or useful information. They do have an explanatory memorandum. They also have a second reading speech like other bills. Okay. Now, in addition to when the budget papers are tabled, the government will table other papers. When the appropriation bills are tabled, the government will table other papers, and these are where most of the information is included. Each year, the government produces a budget overview document. It's sometimes called the budget glossy, and this is really sort of 12, 14 pages of what the government believes is the critical information in terms of explaining their fiscal strategy and explaining what they're going to do. In prior years, I probably would have said that this is maybe not a great place to go to get a full picture of what the government is actually doing, because it's written by the government. It's very much about promoting the government's view of the budget. I won't say that this year, because in the 2014-15 budget, the government announced some changes to its funding to health and education in relation to the states, and it's called sort of $80 billion of funding. It touched on $80 billion of funding to the states and territories. The only place in the budget papers where that was mentioned was actually in the budget overview document. So I won't suggest that you don't read this. I suggest that you do read this. Now, there are four main budget papers each year. There's a budget speech which is produced with the budget papers. This is basically a copy of the second reading speech which is tabled with the appropriation bills. It's very much the Treasurer's view of why the bills should be passed, the Treasurer usually goes into some detail about the economic and financial circumstances of the Commonwealth and the important and significant decisions the Commonwealth's made. Then you get to the four main budget papers. Now, which budget paper you'll intuitively go to will depend to some extent on what your frame of reference is. Now, budget strategy and outlook, if you were working in a bank in Sydney and you're a macroeconomist, this is basically probably the first place you would go. It's got the global and domestic economic forecasts in it. It's got the fiscal forecast, so that's the government's finance forecast. It's got information on expenses aggregated to a large level. It's also got information on the assets, liabilities and debt of the Commonwealth. There are some useful materials in it, particularly Statement 10 at the back of Budget Paper Number 1. It includes long-term data or information on the long-term trends in the Commonwealth's finances. So this data, for example, is about the underlying cash balance, so the headline measure for the Commonwealth, and it goes back to 1971. So often when you hear people talking about, highest taxes in 30 years or lowest taxes in 30 years, they're often looking straight at this kind of table here. Now, the second document is the budget measures document. Now, this is a collection. This basically catalogues all the policy decisions that the Commonwealth has made. So it's grouped into three areas. So revenue measures, which mostly affect revenues. Expenditure measures, which mostly affect revenues. And capital measures, which mostly affect the capital or the assets held by the Commonwealth. Now, this is really, if you're working in a PIC body or you're advising on a particular portfolio area and you want to know whether or not the government has made a decision that benefits you or made a decision that affects you, this is really where you need to go. It has all the individual policy decisions that have been made by the Commonwealth and their financial impact, and also a description of a high-level description of what the measure is intended to achieve or how it is intended to work. It's important to stress that, for example, if you're interested in aged care or something like that, and there's a measure in here that's $500 million for aged care. It's important to remember that that is only the incremental change over what has occurred last year. So these are just incremental changes to essentially the base funding or the activity as it existed immediately before the budget. Okay. The third main budget paper is Federal Financial Relations. Now, this is actually probably the most neglected budget paper. We looked earlier at the level of Commonwealth grants to the states. It's about $100 billion and it's going up to maybe $120 billion each year into the out years. That's about one quarter of the Commonwealth's expenditure each year. So out of a $430 billion budget, $110 billion is going to the states. Now, about half of that is GST revenue. The other half is what's called payments for specific purposes. So mostly this relates to health, education, disability services, but there are other things in there, such as estimates of how much individual jurisdictions might receive under, you know, disaster relief funding if there's been a disaster in a particular jurisdiction. This is, if you want to get a full picture of what's happening, particularly in the areas such as health and education, it's very important to ensure that there haven't been any significant changes, or just acquaint yourself with, I suppose, what the Commonwealth is doing in relation to that, the significant amount of funding it is providing to the states and territories in relation to those activities. Now, budget paper number four is entitled Agency Resourcing. Now, this has a lot of very technical information in it. It's a little bit of a challenging document, to be quite honest, but it also has some very precise and useful information. It shows, for each individual agency and each individual outcome of each agency, the specific amounts that are going to be appropriated, where that money's coming from, according to individual appropriation bills. It's really fine level detail. It also shows the transactions to be conducted on special accounts. So if you're looking at a special account in relation to water, it'll show you whether or not there's going to be $500 million or $2 billion drawn on that in a particular year. It also shows the amount that will be drawn on each individual special appropriation, and also the average staffing levels of individual agencies. So there's a lot of very useful information in there, but it is a somewhat difficult document to navigate. And the final document I want to draw your attention to is really a pretty critical document, particularly if you are revising on a portfolio or you're particularly interested in a particular government activity. These are called portfolio budget statements. Now, I've brought some of them, but there is actually one of these for every portfolio, so I think there's something like 20 portfolio budget statements from last year. There's one portfolio budget statement for each portfolio, and then there is one section within each PBS statement for each individual entity in that portfolio. So if you're after something if you want to find the tax office, you work out that's in the Treasury portfolio, then you need to go and find the tax office section in the Treasury portfolio, PBS. Now, for each individual agency or entity, these documents contain some very useful information. They contain an agency resource statement, so that basically shows all the resources that are available to an individual agency to undertake its activities from all sources. So it brings together all that sort of special account money and your own source revenue and appropriations. It brings it all together and says this is the total amount of resources available to that entity. It also has a reconciliation of budget measures. So if you go back to budget paper number two, and it says, you know, there's a measure that affects this agency, it's going to cost $5 million or $25 million. You want to work out exactly how that affects the activities of the agency. There is a reconciliation in here which will show how that hits each individual activity of the agency. There are also the financial statements of the agency, so that's the operating statement, the cash flow statement, the balance sheet. Particularly the operating statement, I think, all three, I suppose, have some useful information in there. But if, for example, you want to know what the value of the buildings owned by a particular entity is you'd probably go to the balance sheet, look for the value of land and buildings or land and property there. Also, you know, how much they're paying staff, you would go to the operating statement and look at salaries and wages expenses. And then, really, for each individual entity, the government doesn't simply appropriate money to the entity to go off and do anything it wishes with. It appropriates money to an outcome to be delivered by that entity. So the PBS statement includes statements of what the outcomes that the government intends that entity to deliver are. Now, sometimes those statements are a little bit obtuse, but it gives you a clear idea of what the government is actually providing money to that entity to do. And then for each outcome an entity has, and they may have one or more outcomes, there will be at least one program, that is essentially an activity that that entity undertakes to deliver that outcome. There'll be potentially one or more programs. Now, this is particularly important information because if you look at an entity like the Immigration Department, they obviously do a fair range of activities. They do a lot of things, and if you're interested in a particular area and you go to the PBS statement, you'll notice that they actually have multiple outcomes that split out some of, you know, their visa activities from their migration activities. And then within each individual outcome, there'll be individual programs which can give you very clear and precise information about the performance of those activities. There are also performance indicators for each individual program, so potentially how many people are assisted or what the, that kind of numerical information about the impact of the program. Okay? And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you both. We have a few minutes left over for questions. So do I have any questions from anyone?
I'm just wondering, can you explain, is the Future Fund a special account? And can you tell us a little bit about that and how it works?
I think that's a very difficult. I'm not sure. I think there is certainly an issue with, I think it has been excluded. I'm not sure whether it's a special account or whether it's simply excluded through a different mechanism. Whether it's a sort of almost a discretionary exclusion. So I'm not totally sure there. There is also an issue with the Future Fund, which is it's now that the fund has sufficient money or approaching sufficient money to pay all the liabilities which it was established to pay, there is an issue, and those payments should start flowing. There is some point at which it should transition back to being included in the budget proper. But I think at this stage, it is still excluded from the budget, from that direct measure of the budget. I'm not sure if it is a special account, formally a special account. It might be a corporate entity which is distinct from the government, but not a special account.
Does it have a limited shelf life then?
If I recall, in the enabling legislation, it was to be separate from... it had a mandate to generate a certain amount of assets by a particular date, and then once that date arrived, then it was to start basically making payments in relation to superannuation expenses for public servants. So... the shelf life, I think, is at some point under the existing framework, it will return to the government or the budget proper and start making those payments. I don't know what actually happens to the fund post that point, but we can have a look at that if you like.
We can take it on notice, as I said, estimates. The government in recent weeks said that ASIC was going to pay for it, or it was going to be paid for by $120 million coming from banks.
Yeah.
I was just curious how that would be reflected.
Yeah.
Is that a note or is that a BP or something?
Yeah. I saw that announcement. Now, despite the fact that I said that agencies that receive user charges generally would have that as a line in their financial statements that says user charges, the comparable thing would possibly be agricultural levies, where the government goes out and basically imposes a tax, for the lack of a better word, across an entire industry, and then takes that money and transfers it to a particular body. If they had an industry-wide levy, so it wasn't connected with that, the delivery of the service, I suspect the way they might structure it would be that levy, the funds from that levy go into a special account, and then ASIC would be able to draw from that special account. So it would be quarantined in a special account rather than appearing as a line item as own source revenue, is my suspicion of how they might approach that.
Any other questions over the back there?
Just when you're navigating from year to year to do comparisons perhaps between past years and future years, obviously 14-15 is settled as an accounting year. This year is not quite settled, so there's a budgeted amount and an estimate. And then there's the budgeted amount for next year. Any advice on how to navigate that?
Yes. I should have probably said this during my presentation, but the numbers which will appear in the budget this evening are actually the variation, not from last year's budget, but from the MyEFO document that was produced in December. So that's the first point. If you want to want last year's, well, the most recent numbers, you need to go back to the MyEFO document, not back to the budget document. In relation to the numbers that appear in the budget papers as the 2015-16 numbers, you'll notice usually that they have, they're called estimated actuals. Now, this is sort of counterintuitive, but at the beginning of the year, they were estimates. As they've progressed through the year and got closer and closer to the 30th of June, they've got a much, much clearer idea of what the final number will be. So they feel that they can, with some confidence, estimate what the actual outcome at the end of the year is. Remember, they still are only estimates, so there's no, they're not locked down as yet. But at times, given that there's 1 month of the financial or 2 months of the financial year to go, they're often a very, very close, you know, to the final outcome. People do basically use those interchangeably, so they'll take the actual numbers from a couple of years ago, the years that are settled, and then they'll splice in the estimated actual, and usually that gives you a pretty good picture. But you are correct that the numbers for the 2015-16 year that will be presented there in the budget papers this evening to provide that context of what 16-17 numbers look like, they are still at this stage estimates.
Yeah. Do they actually have the 14-15 numbers in this year's budget?
It varies from table to table. So in some contexts, they will have the 14-15 final numbers. In some contexts, they decide that that's not useful and they simply have the estimated actual and then for 15-16 and then the budget year estimates.
I think we have time for just one more question, if there are any last takers. Any final questions? All right. On that basis, thank you all very much for coming. I think most of you would have seen the documents available, the copies of the presentations, and a quick guide to the budget on your way in. Copies of those are, of course, available on our website. I'd also just draw your attention to the flyer. Each year, of course, we do the budget review articles, which are brief articles on sort of the key budget items once they're released. You'll be able to find on our website from tomorrow at about lunchtime a list of the briefing documents that we'll be producing, and then we'll be publishing them progressively as soon as they've done over the next couple of days. Once the budget's released, needless to say, contact us. And these gentlemen, if you have any further questions or would like any analysis or assistance on any of the measures. On that basis, thank you very much for coming, and please join me in thanking the two speakers. Thank you.
know there's a